Quit laughing.
I'm trying.
Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, a professor in Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
Hello, Danielle.
Hi, Katie. How are you holding up?
Things are really amazing and great. And yeah, just like hiking a lot, doing fitness, obviously eating tons, which is great. So things couldn't be better. How about you? What's new in the land of Dartmouth?
Yeah, well, I'm coming to you live from my new headquarters in Hanover, New Hampshire. I have to say that, like you, I am feeling quite a bit more optimistic than probably the last time we talked, because I am in a place that is beautiful, bucolic, quiet, very, very easy to enjoy, despite the otherwise very complicated circumstances in which this world finds itself right now. And I am actually being able to get back to doing a little bit of work on my usual Dante and food related subjects. I know you're also really hard at work right now, wrapping up yet another book, right?
Yeah. So Dan Richer's forthcoming pizza cookbook, we're in the home stretch. The deadline is late September. So we're sort of looking at the manuscript, and I think because Dan Richer's delicious pizza at Razza is really so, it's so like sort of based on over a decade of fine-tuning his choices of ingredients, I'm excited for the next phase before we sort of go into the final edits. And that's talking to some very awesome tomato people like Rob Di Napoli from Bianco Di Napoli. We're going to chat with someone at Stanislaus and sort of get the perspective of two domestic tomato canners and how what's in the can should really be analyzed before it ends up on a pizza, because you want to take into consideration like the acidity and the sweetness and the viscosity and the texture of all these things. And as an agricultural product, those things change all the time, unless you're working with specifically selected and bred plants that create great consistency. So we're going to really break that down in the book. And so hopefully when that tome comes out in fall of 2021, readers will have a really good perspective on how they should be judging tomatoes before they cook them on a pizza. Pretty exciting stuff.
That sounds amazing. Obviously, I cannot wait to read all about this and to learn more about the details that you're talking about. I know our listeners are probably up to date on all episodes now, because we took a nice long summer/global pandemic break. But if you haven't, you can listen to us talking about tomatoes on another episode. And I think that would be the best possible complement to one of the things, or to the ingredient we're going to talk about today also, because it brings us into exactly the space you're talking about, Katie, which is the agricultural vicissitudes that affect the product that we end up getting. And in particular, something that appears to be very streamlined now, but wasn't always the case. And I'm thinking, of course, of eggplants. And
yeah, we're staying with the nightshade family between the tomatoes and the eggplants. We're sticking by it.
Exactly. And, you know, eggplants are, if you're in California, like you are right now, you can still get your hands on lots and lots of different kinds of them. But most people are probably thinking of one kind when they imagine an eggplant right now, right? Wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I mean, when I was growing up in New Jersey, we only had like the big bulbous, almost like purple black skinned eggplant that tended to have like quite a bit of bitterness to it. And when I moved to Italy, and then when visiting California, I was introduced to the huge range, like chromatic range of eggplants, different cultivars that have made their way either to the West Coast of the United States or to mainly the southern part of Italy from their original South and East Asian origins.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the origins you're talking about, Katie, it won't be surprising to anyone who has listened to us talk before, because so many ingredients that we are particularly intrigued by are coming through that Near Eastern, South Asian into Near East into the Mediterranean exchange that often begins with ports in Sicily, and in particular in the high to late Middle Ages with the Arabic presence and then continued influence in our favorite place, Sicily.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about a large territory where botanical species would have been introduced via North African and Mediterranean trade routes. And things like eggplants would have landed and been cultivated and distributed for the first time in a major way in like the 12th. Are we talking 12th century here or a bit earlier?
You know, so often people will give you 12 or even a little bit later for eggplant, but I'll say that it is, I would suspect that we could probably, if we dug in a little bit farther, a little bit deeper, find evidence even earlier, because I think I was mentioning this to you before, Katie, when we were thinking about some of the points we wanted to bring up about eggplants, that eggplant is one of the vegetables that is featured in the Taquinum Sanitatis, which is a dietary text that was very, very popular in the late Middle Ages in Italy, and that has illustrations in it. So when we see eggplant being, you know, featured in a text like that, we're talking about something that had to be fairly familiar and that would have been used by a pretty wide population at that point, because these texts were kind of like the first, they're the equivalent to a kind of like wellness blog right now. They were available to anyone. They were, because they were illustrated to a community of people who were not literate in the sense of being able to read written language, particularly Latin, and they were presenting the kinds of foods that people would eat from the growth stage into the prep stage. So eggplants were definitely pretty popular, or at least something that people were aware of across the peninsula by the time we're getting into the 1200s, no question.
So this text talks about the culinary and medicinal purposes, or even medicinal warnings regarding eggplants. How is it positing this berry slash fruit slash, I guess people have, it's a berry, right?
Well, I was about to say, I'm so glad that you brought this up, because that's one of my favorite kind of secret facts about eggplants, which I don't think people bring up that much. Speaking of its nightshade friends, the argument over whether tomato is a fruit or a vegetable is an old classic. But eggplant never really seems to garner attention in the same way. But eggplants are a berry. And I think that's like the most amazing thing about them, isn't it? I mean, would you ever look at an eggplant and go, oh, what a delicious berry?
Actually, I would not. But I like that about the eggplant as well. Yeah. I'm into it.
So you're right. It's a berry. And the way that the medieval examples of, or the texts that have examples of eggplant in them from that historical moment represent them is in one of two ways. So in the case of the Taquinum, or the dietary treatise that I'm thinking of, that was very popular in the sense that we use the word popular now, but also in the kind of original Latinate sense of it, of the word meaning of the people, of the popolo.
And Italian speakers will know this as popolare, like casa, right, popolare, exactly. Would be the public housing, for example.
Exactly. So there's an easier exchange there. The eggplant, because of that, is sort of de facto associated with a kind of at least common and maybe even lowly kind of person who would have been able to consume this thing, which is not particularly attractive. It can't be eaten fresh. You know, you need to cook it in order to be able to enjoy it. And it has, as you say, a decent amount of bitterness, even in some of the more delicate or smaller varieties. And it doesn't actually bring a whole lot of nutrition at the end of the day. In fact, I'm not sure, I should have probably looked this up before, but I don't think that eggplant is actually a substantial source of really anything at all except water at the end of the day.
I looked it up. It's 92% water, has almost no nutritional value. So it's sponge-like, sort of fibrous body, absorbs flavors, absorbs oils and things that can provide some caloric substance.
Yeah, so you can quickly imagine how it would have been associated with a kind of lower class diet. But it also, I'm sure that I have brought this up before, but it's worth refreshing because it's such a kind of curious part of the foundations for how we have received food and the values of food in our current moment. It's also literally associated with people of lower classes because it is literally grown on the ground, right? So there's a series of texts coming from the late Middle Ages that sort of classifies foods according to their place in a greater hierarchy. And the nightshades and cucurbits, so things like melons and cucumbers and other, what do we call them? Crawlers? No. What are they called? Creepers? Maybe?
Yeah. No. I'm not sure, but yeah, the guys with the vines on the ground and stuff.
Yeah, like exactly. Watermelons and things. You got it. In any case, all of those are associated with people of low economic and social standing because they are literally low to the ground. And so as you kind of move up the food chain, you also move up the social chain. Now,
that's so funny to me, but I guess it makes sense. Like, you've got to sort of get down on your hands and knees to harvest, or at least bend down to harvest melons and squashes, eggplants, and they're kind of dusty and a little sort of less ready to eat than a peach or a persimmon coming off a tree.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And then, you know, speaking of the kind of nutritional value, you have these, the same thing, a melon or an eggplant, both mostly water, often paired with other things in an effort to give them a little bit more intensity of flavor or vibrancy. And then contrast that with, sure, high-growing stone fruit or moving into things like animal proteins, flying birds, other things that would have had extremely delicate and exciting flavors in comparison. So there's a kind of association that eggplant begins to garner early on and really never entirely grows out of, in some ways for good reason, you know, speaking of nutritional value, in other ways for a simple prejudice that just continues to hang over it.
So obviously, listeners will be aware of the modern recipes and uses of eggplant. I mean, perhaps one of the most iconic Italian dishes, eggplant parm, for all of our tri-state area listeners out there, very familiar. Although, like, should be noted, the Italian-American version tends to be quite a bit different and heavier and, like, more battered and oil-laden than its Southern Italian counterpart. But how are people, like, preparing it and cooking it in the late Middle Ages and Renaissance, before tomatoes, for example, are fully integrated into Italian food culture?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, particularly the tomato element of it. The evidence that we have from cookbooks, which is one of the places that I'm always spending a lot of time with my head deep in, is basically giving us examples of eggplant being fried in oil and then salted and peppered. That's some of the most common ones that you see. And certainly I'll take a slice of deep fried eggplant any day of the week, frankly, but they often refer to it in a kind of disdainful way, looking at the people who eat something like that as kind of a desperate attempt to come up with something that tastes decent because their raw ingredients are so poor.
It is a brilliant vehicle for calories, taking something that has like virtually no value and treating it just like a sponge to suck up oil. So you have that energy to like work in the field or work in the market. And it's so simple and so delicious. And like cooking and preparing something like that today would be something that like anyone would enjoy the flavor of. So interesting to think that that was just preparation that was totally, totally dismissed by upper class people.
Yeah. I know. Exactly. Yeah. The point that you're making about it being like a sponge is also, you know, very literal in the case of eggplant. And I'm sure, and, you know, we can get to this in just a second. We don't have to wallow for too long in the medieval Renaissance with me. But the fact that eggplant needs to be, or many times recipes will call for it to be salted in order to leach out some of the water that it contains, reminds us of the fact that it would have been perfect, a thick slice of it dropped into hot oil immediately just absorbs a ton of that. And exactly as you say, Katie, tastes good, but is a quick delivery system for people who need to get out and get back to work. And we definitely see lots of examples of that. In fact, it seems to me like there's probably some suggestion of the fact that also upper class people did enjoy it, but didn't want to be seen to enjoy it, because you'll notice that it comes up sometimes at the end of a culinary text as something to eat alongside a salad or on top of salad. And usually that's the way that you kind of see these so-called poor foods sneaking into upper-class diets, where they give a little coda at the end of a book as though everyone was always eating these extremely elaborate and beautiful feasts. But of course, even Renaissance lords and ladies at the end of the day occasionally just basically had leftovers, right? And so you might have a fresh fried piece of eggplant on top of something just to jazz it up and to make it hot and tasty, basically.
And for the most part, the eggplant is being consumed by either lower class or these fancy lords and ladies with the fried eggplant salad below, like south of Rome. Do we get a sense of that? Or are eggplants something that come to Rome in the 15th century with the Sephardic Jewish diaspora during the Inquisition?
Well, it seems clear that the Jewish diaspora would have brought it up to the center and north of Italy by the end of the 15th century with the expulsion of the scare quotes heretics from the Spanish dominion. The eggplant recipes that I'm thinking of that appear in some of these later cookbooks are certainly being circulated through the central and northern Italian courts by the time we're in the 1500s and into the 1600s. So while clearly there is a much longer and deeper Southern Italian and especially Sicilian tradition, it's still historic, you know, a deep enough, we're still talking 500 years of regular usage in the rest of the peninsula for sure.
Where does something like caponata, fried eggplant enriched with sugar and often served with fried celery, or, I mean, in these, you know, more modern times, tomato is also an element there, but that very famous Sicilian sort of chutney, where does that come into play? And does it evolve as tomatoes, for example, are introduced into the Sicilian diet?
Well, you know, Katie, to some extent, you probably know this better than me, so I'll be quick to turn the question around on you. But I will say that one thing that we immediately notice, just as you're describing it, is that sweet and sour component that clearly it has a North African Near Eastern provenance, and that reminds us of that hard line between kind of Sicilian traditions and much of the rest of the peninsula, because as soon as you get off the ferry or off the plane in Sicily, you're going to notice that there are a variety of dishes that are bringing out those sugar versus salt or vinegar alongside some of the more umami flavors that is not without example other places, but that is, just permeates Sicilian cuisine. And that feels so radically different than the Italian things, especially if you contrast it with something like the eggplant parm that ended up in the U.S. with Italian immigrants moving from other places in the South.
Sure. Or even the eggplant parmesan that you find in the Lower Peninsula, which, you know, would of course feature like fried eggplant. Some people roast it for dietary reasons these days. Mm-hmm. God bless them. tomato and then cheese, sometimes mozzarella, sometimes scamorza, giving that, or like a smoked cheese of some sort, provola, and basil. So you get like, it's delicious, but the flavor profile is kind of limited by those ingredients. Whereas with something like caponata, you do have the like the sweetness from the addition of the sugar, the umami from the tomatoes, as well as acidity and sweetness from the tomatoes. Many recipes call for capers, so that's like yet another savory ingredient. Vinegar is used for another acidic component. Celery, pine nuts might appear. Of course, there are like 850,000 million caponata recipes, but what sort of cuts through them all is that you do get this like incredibly rich, fatty dish, really oil-laden dish, but one that has these acidic components and the sweet and sour contrast that are so common in North African cuisines and Middle Eastern cuisines as well. It's like, it's one of the most delicious things. And I never mind. I never mind putting away a big old plate of it. It's supposed to be kind of like not be a whole meal. It's a side dish situation, but no one's the boss of me, so I can eat it as a meal if I want.
I totally agree. It is honestly one of my all-time favorite things, period, in the entire world. Well-made caponata, which, by the way, is not that easy to find because there's a lot of caponata out there, but there's not a lot of delicious, perfect caponata. And when you find it, I will happily eat it for all the courses of my meal and then take some home with me. Absolutely. No question.
And it's a really good use for fresh, in-season eggplant. And there are a lot of like dishes, especially in the summertime, in which eggplant features pretty heavily. But what do you do in the winter? Like, how do you get your eggplant? And that sort of brings up a category of foods that's super common across Italy's 20 regions. And those are the sottoli. So like literally the under oils and melanzane sott'olio, you know, generally speaking, the eggplant would be grilled and then steeped in oil, sometimes like poached in oil, and then flavored with herbs or garlic or chili pepper. In the case of the smaller eggplants, I've seen them sort of poached whole and then submerged in oil. And that oil does create the sort of, well, scientists can jump in with in our DMs, but I think it kind of creates somewhat of an anaerobic environment to prevent decay and to preserve the eggplant for longer.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. I'm no scientist, but I am a doctor of medieval Italian. I think, though, that the sottoli are probably one of the most common things that you'll see kind of all around Italy, as you are rightly pointing out, Katie. And then again, there are some other kind of hyper-specific, and actually now, even as I'm articulating this, I'm thinking that it's so funny because there are even eggplant dishes in the U.S. that have kind of become hyper-specific also. Like, there are all of these ideas that are very strong surrounding what you're supposed to do with eggplant that I think weirdly have probably very little to do with tradition ultimately and have a lot more to do with more recent peregrinations of this particular ingredient. But as you say, you know, sottoli are trying to preserve it. Caponata, similarly, although it's using fresh things, is also something that has some longevity. How are some of the other ways that people would kind of encounter in Italy eggplant before we maybe get into some of the weirdness of how it made it to the U.S.?
Well, just to stay in the sort of weird vein, although that sounds a bit judgmental, right about this time of year, we just passed Ferragosto, so the 15th of August, when on the Amalfi Coast, it's commonly served as a dessert, fried, layered with like boozy chocolate sauce, studded with pine nuts and candied fruits and served. It's kind of like a chocolate eggplant parm, for lack of a better analogy. And that's hyper-specific to a set of villages along the Amalfi Coast, and obviously none of our listeners are there right now. So check that out in Ferragosto 2021. Another like great way is eggplants are halved and then roasted, par roasted. So you can scrape out the insides and then you can mix the sort of semi-roasted eggplants with like bits of cheese and tomato, or maybe some ground meat. It reminds me about a lot of Imam Bayilda, which is like this, I think it translates to like stuffed belly or something in Turkish. But it's one of those dishes where like you see it in a Turkish like cafeteria or on a menu and you're like, oh my God, that is stuffed eggplant like from Campania. It's such like a beautiful like comparison. Oh, like thrown into a ciambotta, like a sort of ratatouille medley of softened summer produce. I don't think I've encountered any eggplant booze yet, but I'm always on the lookout for those alternative uses. How about you? What are some that you encounter, especially, I mean, most of the things that I've mentioned are south of Rome dishes. Anything from Tuscany and your neck of the woods?
You know, I was trying to think of that also because you actually basically hit all the ones. The eggplant desserts was what I was really thinking of when I was imagining the some of the off map examples that we should highlight. One of the other ones that I think you can find many places, but you mostly find in Rome and further south are polpette di melanzane.
Ah, ma certo.
Yeah, which are delicious. Well, they're so obvious. I was to escape you because what I guess we would translate as eggplant meatballs, kind of, or just they're really just eggplant done in the shape and style of a meatball, but using the pulp or the flesh of the eggplant in place of the meat. And those are delicious. Again, similarly, kind of using the eggplant as something that has substance, but that more than anything else absorbs other flavors. And I think, I mean, in the maybe one other way that you'll see them here and there all around the peninsula for sure, but, you know, as well in the center north, is in the kind of tiny fried squiggles that are then also put under oil or sometimes in vinegar. You know what I'm talking about? When they're like sliced really thin. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I love those. Those are great snacks, actually.
Okay. I just wanted to mention that imam bayılda, the Turkish dish that I referenced, is not, in fact, Turkish, but Ottoman.
Okay.
And it means split belly.
Yeah. Nice. That's such a good one to keep in mind. I also love how that actually draws a slightly different line for us, to your point about because being Ottoman, it's not taking exactly the same trajectory as some of the other foods that would have been coming through the caliphate instead. So a little bit earlier, that would have been a more recent exchange. But, you know, speaking of all of these recipes and of this food traveling across Eurasia, it is, as you started us out by saying, Katie, also one of the most iconic dishes or ingredients within dishes of the Italian diaspora more recently, and one that traveled across the Atlantic in one form and came out on the other side in a radically different one.
Are we talking eggplant parm here, girlfriend?
Well, we're certainly going to have to, and I guess there's a couple others. Rollatini comes to mind also.
Oh, yeah. Got to get your rollatini.
Yeah.
I mean, before we jump into the eggplant parm rollatini thing, I know we talked about this, but can you remind me the parmigiana di melanzane and like that whole etymology situation?
Oh, well, so anything that's parmigiana, so actually, you know what, Katie, I'm so glad you brought this up because there is some disagreement over it still, but it seems very likely that the parmigiana of melanzane, the way that it came about in Italy, is that it was a preparation style for not just eggplant, but for any vegetable that came from Parma. So it takes the name from the place, just like the cheese does, but it is actually not referring to the presence of the cheese in the dish with the eggplant, right? So that leads us to exactly where I'm sure you were imagining bringing this thread to tie it up in a perfect bow, where we get to the United States and where eggplant parmesan is basically a mountain of cheese with one or two vegetables cowering in desperate fear underneath, and where the expectation of what that dish is radically different from where that etymology or even from where the original kind of experimentation with the ingredient came from.
Right. Whereas in Italy, you would find the eggplant for parmigiana di melanzane either just like fried in oil, maybe lightly floured and then fried, maybe lightly battered, but like keyword light, slices very thin. In the Italian-American incarnations, you find thick batters, breadcrumbs, really a crust that's present and undeniable and certainly a feature of the texture and flavor profile. Yeah, often served under like a mountain of marinara sauce, which is quite different than the sort of raw tomato it would be cooked with, or maybe lightly cooked tomato sauce it might be cooked with in Italy. And then all the cheese, so much cheese, lots of cheese. And I love an eggplant parm sandwich. Love me a hoagie. I get down with that. But I also have to have Tums with me when I eat those things now. So really a very like different sort of weight to the food when it's translated for an American palate. And then that's not to mention the fact that eggplant parmesan gives rise to veal parmesan and chicken parmesan, two parmesans that are not found in Italy.
Yeah, that's actually maybe one thing that you can really never find, right? Like, I have never once come across a chicken parmesan dish or anything really near it in Italy. And veal parmesan is so far outside of the realm of possibility there that I think even pronouncing those words would be terms for grounds for expulsion from the table, probably.
I mean, also like the sort of industrial post-war food movement has introduced the cotoletta.
Yes.
Pollo, which is basically like a frozen, like a big flattened frozen chicken McNugget. It's supposed to approximate the texture of poultry, but it's kind of just like ground up cartilage and meat that's like formed into a big patty. And the cotoletta is like, it's frozen food that people serve at home. Like I've had it served with melted cheese on it, but never in the sort of like casserole version of an eggplant parm. And then also never on a, well, I shouldn't say never on a sandwich, because you go to every Roman bar and they've got the cotoletta with like the flaccid lettuce leaf that's just kind of like languishing there. So scratch that. I stand corrected.
That's true. The chicken cutlet sandwich is a thing. It is a thing that I don't think many Italians would take great pride in, but it does exist. And the sandwiching of eggplant parm, though, to bring us back to our star ingredient, is the kind of thing that I think most people would be genuinely shocked by, and or would have been until very recently, when the kind of trend for doing these kind of, you know, wacky sandwiches and street food became more popular in Italy. And that's really just in the last few years, even.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The role of parmigiani and melanzane was to be like on a hot summer day, that might be like your main dish with like a little salad. But in any event, it would be part of like a coursed meal, and the eggplant parm sub, grinder, hoagie, whatever your local nomenclature calls for, that's more of a meal, or like two meals, or probably three meals if we're judging it from like a daily recommended caloric intake. But it's definitely supposed to be a substantial like standalone, washed down ideally with a 64-ounce Diet Coke.
Oh, Katie, I'm going to FedEx you some more antacids and look forward to when we can toast over a sandwich and maybe in place of a Diet Coke, a nice something, maybe a cold fondo to remind our listeners also to listen back to our Prosecco episode and enjoy.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of really nice messages from listeners who have been quite concerned about our absence. It is simply a garbage pandemic time. So we haven't done much episodes, nor have I learned much, maintained much English. We haven't done many episodes during COVID, but we plan to change that. And in the meantime, you can totally catch up on episodes like Prosecco, che altro, che abbiamo fatto, che adesso non mi ricordo, tomatoes, prosciutto. Yeah.
Mozzarella old ones, nocino, which are nice ones for summertime. I would say I'd love for people to go back to Negroni, which I think a lot of people enjoyed. And it feels like some of those ones are particularly just joyful as we're making drinks and having fun together. So I, you know, there's, to be honest, Katie, there are ones that I like and ones that I think, ugh, I wish we could go back and do that one again another way. And then I hear from listeners who absolutely love the ones that I felt, you know, less excited about. So I hope that all of our episodes continue to bring people some distraction and some welcome fresh knowledge or refreshed knowledge, and that they will remind everyone that new episodes are on the way, even if they're not dropping as fast and furious as you hoped, but they will be. We're recording regularly now and can't wait to continue to talk with all of our fans about the upcoming products that we will feature and can dive into with the kind of same energy, hopefully, that we've had before, now that we've had a little bit of a break.
And in the meantime, While you're catching up with those episodes, you can find us on social media. I'm at Katie Parla on all the platforms.
They can find me at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet. They can find some more info about the podcast and us on golapodcast.com. And they can, if they're feeling super generous, and God knows this is a tough time for everyone, but if you have a couple extra dollars and you want to make sure that the Gola podcast continues to exist, and you're kind enough to bother giving 2 minutes of your time, go to anchor.fm/Gola, where you will find an opportunity to throw us a little cash and make sure this thing stays afloat.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
We thank you, and we look forward to talking to you again, or I look forward to talking to Katie again, and having everyone listening on the next episode of Gola.
Ciao.